Epilogue. America today is a National Socialist's dream come true. Individuals are computerized, databased, logged, and categorized. Video cameras, motion sensors, metal detectors, and spy satellites monitor our movements, while think tanks and foundations study our every habit. We are constantly bombarded with official pronouncements and advertising. Television is everywhere, in bars, waiting rooms, airports, and usually constantly on in our very living rooms. In our fast-paced society, no one has time to think, much less read deeply. Business, especially corporate business, is king. Giant corporations, governed by faceless directors answering to shadowy owners, control everything from water to wingnuts. Even the time-honored profession of soldiering has been usurped by private corporate armies like Blackwater, in 2007 already being accused of becoming America's version of the Nazi brown shirts. Meanwhile, the American taxpayer is footing the bill, even though, as convincingly shown in Aaron Russo's 2006 documentary, America, Freedom to Fascism, there is no law requiring Americans to pay an income tax. Of course, the IRS, through its myriad rules and regulations, can drag into court and even jail those who fail to fulfill voluntary compliance. Fascism's principles are wafting in the air today, surreptitiously masquerading as something else, challenging everything we stand for. The cliché that people and nations learn from history is not only overused, but also overestimated. Often we fail to learn from history, or draw the wrong conclusions. Sadly, historical amnesia is the norm, stated author Dr. Lawrence W. Britt in an article for Free Inquiry, a long-standing publication of the Council for Secular Humanism, which promotes secular humanist principles. Following a careful study of the regimes of Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, Franco's Spain, Salazar's Portugal, Papadopoulos's Greece, Pinochet's Chile, and Suharto's Indonesia, Britt concluded that these fascist governments had observable similarities. Analysis of these seven regimes reveals 14 common threads that link them in recognizable patterns of national behavior and abuse of power, he noted. These basic characteristics are more prevalent and intense in some regimes than in others, but they all share at least some level of similarity. Britt's 14 characteristics of a fascist regime, many sounding ominously close to what's happening today in the United States, include powerful and continuing expressions of nationalism. From the prominent displays of flags and bunting to the ubiquitous lapel pins, the fervor to show patriotic nationalism both on the part of the regime itself and of citizens caught up in its frenzy was always obvious. Catchy slogans, pride in the military, and demands for unity were common themes in expressing this nationalism. It was usually coupled with a suspicion of things foreign that often bordered on xenophobia. Examples of such patriotic zeal may be found in the ever-present yellow ribbons showing support for U.S. troops to the plethora of American flags and bunting at large public events such as the Super Bowl. Disdain for the importance of human rights. The regimes themselves viewed human rights as of little value and a hindrance to realizing the objectives of the ruling elite. Through clever use of propaganda, the population was brought to accept these human rights abuses by marginalizing, even demonizing, those being targeted. When abuse was egregious, the tactic was to use secrecy, denial, and disinformation. In November 2007, former federal judge Michael B. Mukasey was sworn in as Attorney General of the United States, despite contentious confirmation hearings focused on the issue of torturing prisoners. He replaced Alberto R. Gonzalez, who was criticized for his part in crafting the Bush administration's secretive legal arguments permitting the torture of suspects. Mukasey, who served 18 years as judge of U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York, presided over the trials of Omar Abdelrahman and El Said Nosseir, the convicted bombers of the World Trade Center, in 1993. The trial of Jose Padilla, the man declared an enemy combatant by President Bush and the only person convicted in connection with the 9/11 attacks. And the lawsuits between World Trade Center leaser Larry Silverstein and several insurance companies over damages stemming from the 9/11 attacks. Identification of enemies, scapegoats, as a unifying cause. The most significant common thread among these regimes was the use of scapegoating as a means to divert the people's attention from other problems, to shift blame for failures, and to channel frustration in controlled directions. The methods of choice, relentless propaganda and disinformation, were usually effective. Often, the regimes would incite spontaneous acts against the target scapegoats, usually communists, socialists, liberals, Jews, ethnic and racial minorities, traditional national enemies, members of other religions, secularists, homosexuals, and terrorists. Active opponents of these regimes were inevitably labeled as terrorists and dealt with accordingly. Examples of such tactics can be heard from the mouths of those who constantly use racial slurs. Afghanistan's former freedom fighters have semantically changed into insurgents, then into Al-Qaeda terrorists in the news columns, while such epithets as raghead and sand nigger are commonly used in the general population. The supremacy of the military and avid militarism. Ruling elites always identified closely with the military and the industrial infrastructure that supported it. A disproportionate share of national resources was allocated to the military, even when domestic needs were acute. The military was seen as an expression of nationalism and was used whenever possible to assert national goals, intimidate other nations, and increase the power and prestige of the ruling elite. The U.S. military budget for many years has consumed the bulk of the national spending. President Bush's 2008 budget provides $439.3 billion for the Department of Defense's base budget, a 7% increase over 2006 and a whopping 48% increase over 2001. This figure does not include military-related expenditures such as nuclear weapons research or the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Neither does it count trust funds, anticipated costs of Social Security, and Veterans Administration costs of services to veterans. The government practice of combining trust and federal funds began during the Vietnam War, thus making the human needs portion of the budget seem larger and the military portion smaller, according to literature from the War Resisters League, WRL, an anti-war organization founded in 1923. By totaling all government figures relating to the military, the WRL estimated that more than half, 51%, of all federal spending goes to the military. Rampant sexism. Beyond the simple fact that the political elite and the national culture were male-dominated, these regimes inevitably viewed women as second-class citizens. They were adamantly anti-abortion and also homophobic. These attitudes were usually codified in draconian laws that enjoyed strong support by the orthodox religion of the country, thus lending the regime cover for its abuses. This practice is less prevalent in the United States today, although many women still find it difficult to break through what has been termed the glass ceiling, in which they can see higher positions in the workplace, but never seem to get there. Modern America also differs from Nazi Germany and other cultures in that women are beginning to fill the corporate chairs formerly held by men. Many seem agreeable to advancing fascist and globalist philosophy. A controlled mass media. Under some of the regimes, the mass media were under strict direct control and could be relied upon never to stray from the party line. Other regimes exercised more subtle power to ensure media orthodoxy. Methods included the control of licensing and access to resources, economic pressure, appeals to patriotism, and implied threats. The leaders of the mass media were often politically compatible with the power elite. The result was usually successful in keeping the general public unaware of the regime's excesses. As previously detailed, the American corporate mass media today is essentially in the hands of six giant multinational communications corporations. The owners of these corporations are proponents of free trade in business policies, yet coverage of alternative news and views is mostly ignored. One of our best-kept secrets is the degree to which a handful of huge corporations control the flow of information in the United States. Whether it is television, radio, newspapers, magazines, books, or the Internet, a few giant conglomerates are determining what we see, hear, and read. And the situation is likely to become much worse as a result of radical deregulation efforts by the Bush administration and some horrendous court decisions, warned Congressman Bernie Sanders, adding, "This is an issue that Congress can no longer ignore." Obsession with national security. Inevitably, a national security apparatus was under direct control of the ruling elite. It was usually an instrument of oppression, operating in secret and behind many constraints. Its actions were justified under the rubric of protecting national security, and questioning its activities was labeled unpatriotic or even treasonous. While all Americans should be concerned about national security, many see it as a pretext to strip away constitutional rights. Thoughtful persons also worry about a man like Michael Chertoff, son of a Jewish rabbi, who has been accused of having dual citizenship, American and Israeli, and was a major architect of Bush administration policies, being named Secretary of the Homeland Security Department. Religion and ruling elite tied together. Unlike communist regimes, the fascist and proto-fascist regimes were never proclaimed godless by their opponents. In fact, most of the regimes attached themselves to the predominant religion of the country and chose to portray themselves as militant defenders of that religion. The fact that the ruling elite's behavior was incompatible with the precepts of the religion was generally swept under the rug. Propaganda kept up the illusion that the ruling elites were defenders of the faith and opponents of the godless. A perception was manufactured that opposing the power elite was tantamount to an attack on religion. Earlier in this work, the obvious parallels have been drawn between the use of religion in Nazi Germany and modern America to support government policies. Power of corporations protected. Although the personal life of ordinary citizens was under strict control, the ability of large corporations to operate in relative freedom was not compromised. The ruling elite saw the corporate structure as a way to not only ensure military production in developed states, but also as an additional means of social control. Members of the economic elite were often pampered by the political elite to ensure a continued mutuality of interests, especially in the repression of have-not citizens. According to the Federalism Project of the American Enterprise Institute, a group that conducts and sponsors original research on American federalism, consumer advocates, plaintiffs' attorneys, and state officials argue that broad federal preemption claims, often by federal regulatory agencies, without a clear congressional mandate, interfere with the state's historic role in protecting citizens against corporate misconduct. Corporations and federal agencies respond that preemption is often the only viable safeguard against unwarranted state interferences with the national economy. In a 2006 article in the Los Angeles Times, Alan C. Miller and Myron Levin noted how a series of steps by federal agencies were meant to shield leading industries from state regulation and civil lawsuits on the grounds that they conflict with federal authority. Power of labor suppressed or eliminated. Since organized labor was seen as the one power center that could challenge the political hegemony of the ruling elite and its corporate allies, it was inevitably crushed or made powerless. The poor formed an underclass that was viewed with suspicion or outright contempt. Under some regimes, being poor was considered akin to a vice. As previously noted, anti-labor actions of the Bush administration prompted Jack Hayman, an official of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, to state that Bush is effectively declaring war on the working class here. Those with long memories know that labor news has largely dropped from the mainstream media's radar screen. disdain and suppression of intellectuals and the arts. Intellectuals and the inherent freedom of ideas and expression associated with them were anathema to these regimes. Intellectual and academic freedom were considered subversive to national security and the patriotic ideal. Universities were tightly controlled, politically unreliable faculty harassed or eliminated. Unorthodox ideas or expressions of dissent were strongly attacked, silenced, or crushed. To these regimes, art and literature had to serve the national interest, or they had no right to exist. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, many conservative groups on college campuses denounced academic freedom, according to a report by John K. Wilson, coordinator of the Independent Press Association's Campus Journalism Project. Other academics were fired or reprimanded for merely speaking out on the issues of war or questioning the official story of 9/11. Obsession with crime and punishment. Most of these regimes maintain draconian systems of criminal justice with huge prison populations. The police were often glorified and had almost unchecked power, leading to rampant abuse. Normal and political crime were often merged into trumped-up criminal charges and sometimes used against political opponents of the regime. Fear and hatred of criminals, or traitors, was often promoted among the population as an excuse for more police power. The United States today has a higher incarcerated population than all European jails combined, and in certain areas, such as Washington, D.C., police presence is at an all-time high. One visitor to Washington in the summer of 2007 asked a police officer why there were so many cops around. He replied, "People would rather have security than freedom." Rampant cronyism and corruption. Those in business circles and close to the power elite often used their position to enrich themselves. This corruption worked both ways. The power elite would receive financial gifts and property from the economic elite, who in turn would gain the benefit of government favoritism. Members of the power elite were in a position to obtain vast wealth from other sources as well, for example, by stealing national resources. With the national security apparatus under control and the media muzzled, this corruption was largely unconstrained and not well understood by the general population. The cronyism and outright nepotism of the Bush administration has been well documented. Elizabeth Cheney, the vice president's daughter, was named as a deputy secretary of state in late February 2002, and within about a week, her husband, Philip Perry, became chief counsel for the Office of Management and Budget, where he joined director Mitchell Daniels, whose sister, Deborah, is an assistant attorney general. "That's just the beginning," noted Washington Post reporter Dana Milbank. Among Deborah Daniels' colleagues at Justice is young Chuck James, whose mother, Kay Coles James, is the director of the Office of Personnel Management, and whose father, Charles Sr., is a top Labor Department official. Charles James Sr.'s boss, Labor Secretary Elaine L. Chao, knows about having family members in government. Her husband is Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell, and her department's top lawyer, Labor Solicitor Eugene Scalia, is the son of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Ken Melman, the White House political director, regularly calls his younger brother Bruce, an assistant commerce secretary, to get his input. Former Secretary of State Colin L. Powell is the father of Michael Powell, who chaired the Federal Communications Commission. An informal survey of 415 historians conducted by George Mason University's History News Network found that 8 in 10, or 81%, of the responding historians rated Bush's presidency as an overall failure. One respondent to the survey wrote that Bush ranks with U.S. Grant as the worst. His oil interests and Cheney's corporate Halliburton contracts smack of the same corruption found under Grant. Central to the belief were the numerous Bush administration scandals, including the deceit that preceded the invasion of Iraq, the Abu Ghraib mistreatment of prisoners, pre-9/11 intelligence failures, the $2.3 trillion missing from the Pentagon announced by Donald Rumsfeld the day before 9/11. The mishandling of the Katrina disaster, which resulted in the resignation of Bush's appointee, Michael D. Brown, as director of FEMA. Bush's Medicare prescription drug plan that shifted 6.2 million low-income seniors whose medications had been covered by Medicare over to private insurers. The non-competition government contracts to Halliburton, Dick Cheney's former employer, and the substitution of political ideals for science. In 2004, the Union of Concerned Scientists issued a statement blasting the administration's politicization of science. Ultimately, this statement was signed by 4,062 scientists, including 51 Nobel laureates, 63 National Medal of Science recipients, and 195 members of the national academies. BuzzFlash.com, which styles itself as a marketplace for progressives, after listing several debacles and scandals of the Bush administration, said it operated in a culture of cronyism and corruption. Fraudulent elections. Elections in the form of plebiscites or public opinion polls were usually bogus. When actual elections with candidates were held, they would, as a rule, be perverted by the power elite to get the desired result. Common methods included maintaining control of the election machinery, intimidating and disenfranchising opposition voters, destroying or disallowing legal votes, and, as a last resort, turning to a judiciary beholden to the power elite. Americans are well aware of the controversies concerning the presidential elections of 2000 and 2004. George W. Bush's first term was decided by the Supreme Court, not by the voters. And it was just as bad in 2004. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., writing in Rolling Stone magazine, stated, "Republicans prevented more than 350,000 voters in Ohio from casting ballots or having their votes counted, enough to have put John Kerry in the White House." Controversy over both elections continues today, and in 2008, charges of vote fraud were already being voiced in the state primary elections, primarily over computer voting machines. Many Americans noticed the similarities between George W. Bush's unprovoked attacks on Afghanistan and Iraq and Hitler's unprovoked attacks on Poland, the Low Countries, and France. In both cases, the pretext for invasion proved false, and reservists were used rather than the option to resort to a military draft. In early 2008, a study by the nonpartisan Center for Public Integrity documented 935 false statements by the Bush administration in the months leading up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Nearly 5 years after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, an exhaustive examination of the record shows that the statements were part of an orchestrated campaign that effectively galvanized public opinion and, in the process, led the nation to war under decidedly false pretenses, stated the CPI report. Most people would term this telling lies. "Does any of this ring alarm bells?" asked Britt. "Of course not. After all, this is America, officially a democracy with the rule of law, a constitution, a free press, honest elections, and a well-informed public constantly being put on guard against evils. Historical comparisons like these are just exercises in verbal gymnastics." Maybe. Maybe not. It seems that by comparing Brit's characteristics of fascism to current events, the argument can definitely be made that globalist fascists are turning the once free and independent United States into a not-so-profitable subsidiary of their global corporate structure, their empire of the rich. You are free to accept this idea or not. But when secular humanists, conservative Christians, Jews, liberal Democrats, bedrock Republicans, and moderates, not to mention the activist fringe elements, all start issuing the same warning against fascism, perhaps it is time we start paying serious attention. Commentators like Noam Chomsky and Gore Vidal have spoken out against the national security state from the left. The late Senator Barry Goldwater and evangelist Pat Robertson have spoken out from the right. Even mainstream centrists like commentators Bill Moyers and attorney Jerry Spence have warned of the abuses of a secret government. When historical figures, along with concerned citizens from opposite ends of the political spectrum, all say the same thing, it is time to consider the true state of the American Union. And perhaps time to stand up and be counted for true freedom, freedom from the corporate state. The Reverend Irwin W. Lutzer, senior pastor of Moody Church in Chicago, wrote, "We must support our government, but we must be ready to criticize it or even defy it when necessary. Patriotism is commendable when it is for a just cause. Every nation has the right to defend itself, the right to expect the government to do what is best for its citizens. However, if the German church has taught us the dangers of blind obedience to government, we must eschew the mindless philosophy, my country, right or wrong." Media critic Michael Parenti observes, "To oppose the policies of a government does not mean you are against the country or the people that the government supposedly represents. Such opposition should be called what it really is, democracy, or democratic dissent, or having a critical perspective about what your leaders are doing. Either we have the right to democratic dissent and criticism of these policies, or we all lie down and let the leader, the Führer, do what is best, while we follow uncritically and obey whatever he commands. That's just what the Germans did with Hitler, and look where it got them." There are those who would argue that it is perhaps unpatriotic, or at least not politically correct, to speak out on issues involving taxation, immigration, political beliefs, race, eugenics, or criticism of the military-industrial complex. The term political correctness, which has entered today's discourse, is defined by the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as conforming to a belief that language and practices which could offend political sensibilities, as in matters of sex or race, should be eliminated. Today, many believe that definition has grown to include the perceived need to conform to restrictions on speech and behavior set by politicians, corporate leaders, and other self-appointed authorities. This is the same self-imposed restriction that was adopted by too many Germans during the Third Reich. Not only was the man on the street afraid to speak out against the Nazi regime, but free speech was denied the intelligentsia. Nazi academic Walter Schulz, in 1939, stated that the reorganization of the entire university system must begin with people who understand that freedom has its limits and conform to National Socialist thinking. Germans in the Third Reich did not know the term political correctness, but they well understood the penalties for freely voicing their opinions. Recent legislation targeting so-called hate speech can easily slip into official punitive action against any speech that arouses the ire of politicians, police, or judges. Jonathan Rauch, reporting in Harper's Magazine, noted that equating verbal violence with physical violence is a treacherous, mischievous business. Rauch quoted author Salman Rushdie, who was sentenced to death in absentia by Muslim ayatollahs after writing a book they claimed slandered the beliefs of millions of Muslims. "What is freedom of expression?" asked Salman Rushdie. "Without the freedom to offend, it ceases to exist." Rauch wrote that the public should learn a lesson from Rushdie's experience. Rauch proclaimed, "The campaigns to eradicate prejudice, all of them, the speech codes and workplace restrictions and mandatory therapy for accused bigots and all the rest, should stop, now. The whole objective of eradicating prejudice, as opposed to correcting and criticizing it, should be repudiated as a fool's errand." Even though the German Nazis preached the unity of the folk and spoke out against the old divisions of class and education, the leaders operated in an entirely different manner. In reality, the Third Reich was a network of rival leaders, each with his own followers and his own patronage, noted George Moss in his book, Nazi Culture. Hitler kept them competing against one another, and in this way was able to control the whole leadership structure. Likewise, the globalist rulers of America pit bureaucrats, politicians, academics, corporate leaders, and the public against one another in an agenda of divide and conquer. They maintain control in a society fragmented by combative ideologies and philosophies, as well as competing corporate interests. In today's America, it seems the only common denominator is consumerism and debt. Because of their loss of control over Hitler, the globalists learned well the dangers of allowing any one individual to gain the power over masses of people. Consequently, there has not been one prominent figure in recent American history who has commanded the popular respect and esteem of a majority of the population. Even the assassinated President John F. Kennedy, beloved by so many, never held popular goodwill to the extent of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Since World War II, no national leader has gained the stature of Roosevelt, Churchill, or Hitler. Hitler's world has gone forever. But many of the basic attitudes and prejudices which went into his worldview are still with us, waiting to be actualized, to be directed into a new mass consciousness, prophesied Professor Moss from the relatively naive year of 1966. Ladislas Farrago, author of Aftermath, Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich, wrote, "The despicable forces loosed by the Third Reich are not expunged, although, like some virulent virus, they may have changed to other forms and be difficult to identify. They remain malignant and as potentially dangerous as before." In his 1997 book, The Beast Reawakens, Martin Lee wrote, "Fascism is on the march again." Unchecked corporate power has, to a significant degree, stultified the democratic process, and fascist groups in Europe and the United States feed upon this malaise. These sentiments came from writers unaware of the fascist globalists' plan being woven around them. Yet, they could sense that Americans could easily fall sway to the pernicious ideology of National Socialism. The biggest stumbling block to the plans of the globalists has always been the United States, with its tradition of individual freedom, its constitution that guarantees that freedom, and the fact that so many Americans own firearms to protect their freedoms. But true freedom is a transient quality. National politicians no longer refer to the Republic because modern America has ceased to be one. It is now an empire, a new Reich. Obviously, there are dissimilarities between Hitler's Third Reich and the new American Reich. After all, the United States today is a very different time and culture. But it has been demonstrated how the same philosophies and methodologies employed by the same families, corporations, and organizations that at one time supported Hitler's Third Reich have now found roots in modern America. It has been necessary for these fascist globalists to break up the United States into divisions of race, sex, age, generation, and culture. This has been accomplished through a degrading of popular culture, downgrading the education process, permitting a steady flow of illegal immigrants, and the fragmentation of the population over issues such as abortion, immigration, non-heterosexual relationships, and foreign policy. Control over a diminished national economy and corporate downsizing has brought undue stress on workers, resulting in the gradual destruction of the nuclear family. None of this construction of the new American empire has come about suddenly. The global national socialists, Nazis, are in it for the long haul. The owners of multinational corporations, with their membership in secret societies, know their goals will not be achieved overnight, although since 9/11, they seem to have redoubled their efforts, speeding up the timetable. While businessmen deal with yearly quarters, and the average worker lives for his weekly paycheck, these people look ahead 50 years, or 100, if that's what it takes. They realize that their program of a global fascist socialism is the only means of maintaining their power and control, the only way, in their view, to maintain the purity of their race and class. They laugh at the concepts of true individual freedom and multiculturalism, for they have no faith in the innate goodness of humankind or its ability for self-government. They have no real faith in God and use religious ideals and concepts merely as another tool for social control. The struggle against such steadfast will to power and its attendant control will not be easy. Sacrifices and change will have to be made in all areas of society. Lifestyles will have to be altered. But it can be done, hopefully, before the United States falls into depression, anarchy, and then a police state. New energy sources and technologies are lurking in the wings. Technological breakthroughs await only the change of attitude on the part of conventional politics, commerce, and finance. A sea change in the public consciousness is well underway, although it is not reflected in the corporate-controlled mass media. Yet it is happening. Informed consumers are beginning to realize they can vote with their spending. If enough people refuse to buy a certain product, whether it's a brand of car, gasoline, or something else, or even reject a federal policy proposal, it can force a change of direction in the controllers. We may do well to recall the words of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who had to deal with a previous New World Order. In a 1940 address, he stated, "The history of recent years proves that the shootings and the chains and the concentration camps are not simply the transient tools, but the very altars of modern dictatorships. They may talk of a new order in the world, but what they have in mind is only a revival of the oldest and the worst tyranny, in that there is no liberty, no religion, no hope. The proposed new order is the very opposite of a United States of Europe or a United States of Asia. It is not a government based upon the consent of the governed. It is not a union of ordinary, self-respecting men and women to protect themselves and their freedom and their dignity from oppression. It is an unholy alliance of power and self to dominate and to enslave the human race. It appears that the New World Order is really just the Old World Order packaged with modern advertising slickness, new names, logos, and slogans. What once was traditional American conservatism has been molded into fascist forms, beginning with the infusion of National Socialism ideals into the military-industrial complex, which then spread into science, corporate life, the mass media, and even political parties. This change has been engineered by the globalist elite, who hold monopolies over basic resources, energy, pharmaceuticals, transportation, and telecommunications, including the news media. As detailed throughout this work, the same men, families, and companies that first supported communism in Russia funded and supported National Socialism in pre-war Germany. With the defeat of the Germans, they simply shifted their attention to the United States. They were abetted by Nazis financed by the stolen wealth of Europe, perhaps including Solomon's treasure, and utilizing a vast network of worldwide corporations. Thousands of Nazis escaped to both North and South America, their way facilitated by supporters in Wall Street, the Bank of England, and the Vatican. Using German advances in the study of the human mind, behavior, and propaganda, these self-styled globalists are now attempting to subdue the American population through a maze of government policies, drugs, a dumbed-down education system, and a controlled corporate mass media. Political and corporate leadership continually swap roles, creating a merger of the state and industry, the very definition of fascism. Mergers and leveraged takeovers have concentrated corporate power into fewer and fewer hands, many of those directly connected through banking and corporate ties to pre-war support for the Nazis. Law enforcement personnel increasingly no longer wear the blue uniforms of police sworn to serve and protect, but black body armor with the German-style military helmets initially dubbed the Fritz by the soldiers. Even the fields of religion, education, and entertainment are being used to transform whole generations of formerly free Americans into cowed and subservient members of an increasingly national socialist system. Is the new American empire, as it is described in numerous books and articles, in danger of becoming an empire of the wealthy, a fascist Fourth Reich? Hitler's thousand-year Reich collapsed after a mere 12 years. How long before the end of the New World Order's Fourth Reich in America? An account of the fall of the Fourth Reich has not yet been written, for it has yet to happen. If and how this is to be accomplished is up to you, dear listener. This concludes The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers. Or call toll-free 877-7-TANTOR to request a catalog.